Hi.
So I am here this morning. I'm Emily Bazelon. I'm one of the editors of Slate's new women's site, Double X. I am here with my co-editor, Hannah Rosen.
Hello.
Hello. And we are going to talk about what if Hillary had been elected president. It is the one-year anniversary of the election that, of course, Barack Obama won, and we're going to send ourselves into an imagined world of counterfactuals for a few minutes. We're also going to talk about recent stories about how testosterone-laden and basketball-loving the Obama White House is, and then we will close by talking about our favorite television show of the moment, Mad Men. At least it's my favorite show. It's my only show right now. So, Hannah, in trying to put yourself through the mental gymnastics of imagining a world in which Hillary Clinton was president, what stood out to you the most about how that world would be different from the one we actually live in?
You know, it's funny. There was only one moment when this counterfactual happened to me naturally, and in other words, I had that twinge pang of regret, and it actually was when I was reading that basketball story, which was written by my very good friend Mark Leibovich, and actually this was a spinoff of the basketball story that ran in the New York Times last week about kind of how the White House is frat house, you know, all the testosterone in the White House, how everyone's high-fiving each other and Rahm Emanuel and how aggro everyone is. And, you know, even though Obama's obviously like a strong woman-loving guy, that he can't help but kind of recreate. And, of course, the Obama administration completely bristled and was like, oh, my God, no, not us. We're so feminist. We're so feminist. But I did think to myself, you know, now that I work at an all-women's magazine, there just is a difference. It's like it's one of these post-feminist questions that, you know, we can't pretend there's no difference. You know, there's just, you know, I remember when I went with David and Slate, Emily, now that you're gone, now that you're gone from the office of the Washington office, is a very guy office,
right.
You know, they watch a lot of soccer, they like break the day to watch soccer. Like, we would never break the day to watch soccer or play basketball.
Right, and so, if you're not there to make fun of them or I'm not there, then it's like totally unremarkable.
Right, exactly, it's unremarkable. They just kind of, hey dude, la, watch soccer, and then they put on the game and they just kind of grunt at each other. This is like in the middle of the workday, right? So there's just a difference, whereas you and I, you know, this is such gender stereotyping. Like, when we talked this morning, my son broke my nose. That's a little aside here. I hope you can't tell that my nose is kind of broken. But
I do not mean to be laughing over your
broken nose.
We've already cracked up about this morning.
You know, Emily kindly asked me all about it and how's your nose and like that. So, I could tell more stories on my husband and his manly office. But there is a subtle difference. So I thought to myself, not like how horrible and sexist, that was certainly not my thought, and not that Dee Dee Myers point of like, you know, why aren't there more women that, you know, faces like mine in the inner circle. Like, I wasn't having that kind of 1991 sensation, but I was having the thought, you know, it kind of would have been cool to see. It left me with a pang for wanting to see what a female-only White House looked like, and we haven't gotten to the substance yet in terms of foreign and domestic policy, which we will, but that was my genuine about Hillary and thinking, like, it will be nice to have a woman president, you know, because it's not like his White House is particularly African-American. It doesn't really satisfy that part of our imagination, I don't think.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, there certainly are lots of prominent black people in his administration, but they're obviously surrounded by a lot of white faces, too, so I think you're right. You know, I had a more kind of 1991 traditional bean-counting response, which was to think about the symbolism of what it's like when the White House, when the inner circle projects as male and as, like, aggro male, as you were talking about. I think that does matter, and over time, if it continues, then you have women who have less power, because being intimate with the president is a form of power. So I think that it has actual implications for the way in which women are perceived and the actual power that they wield. But I'm also left feeling sympathetic to the president in the sense that, this is total psychobabble, I suppose, but one of the reasons I think maybe he doesn't feel like he has to have a lot of women advisors who are very close to him in that kind of jokey, bantering way is that he has that relationship with Michelle Obama. He seems like he is genuinely close with his wife, precisely in that way. And I feel a little remiss faulting the president. First of all, it seems unfair to demand certain, you know, standards for one's closest relationships anyway. Like, you're supposed to be paying attention to what sex people are or anything else about them in that those very personal decisions. But particularly if the reason there aren't more women close to him is because that role is being filled by his wife. I mean, as a wife, I find it hard to argue with that.
Right, right. Although, you know, as we learned a lot about their marriage in that great New York Times Magazine piece by Jodi Kantor this weekend, but then, you know, one of our own writers, Liza Mundy, issued a correction, which is like, it is true that their marriage is sort of egalitarian and familiar to me. I mean, in the model of sort of marriages of my friends, and they seem to defer to each other's ambitions and the way they talk with each other, and there does seem to be a sort of genuine kind of connection and uncomplicated love between them. On the other hand, you know, she really has, as Liza pointed out, kind of taken a backseat. You know, she really has, if you sort of take a rolling reel of their life, the reel would mostly show Michelle Obama dealing with the domestic sphere while Barack Obama is out, you know, community organizing, running for office, running for president. Like, even though the intentions are good, the reality is, you know, not, you know, you and I would get frustrated, let's say, under that.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And I mean, I think in the Jodi Kantor interview, Michelle Obama addressed this directly. I mean, Jodi asked the Obamas whether it's possible to have a true and equal partnership if one of the spouses is the president. And Barack Obama sort of tried to answer, and then it seemed like kind of subsided to play it safe. And Michelle Obama basically said, look, I don't have my own career, and mm-hmm. that is a big factor in all of this.
Right.
So I like her candor on that point, but it is certainly an issue.
Right, and, you know, I think, you know, asking the question that way sets the bar really high, right? It's like, if your husband's the president, of course it's not possible to have an equal marriage. Right. But I think what that overlooks is the sort of many years before that. You know, what about when your husband was a community organizer or a professor and, you know, all these other things? Like, what was it like then? You know, so we're comparing him to other models in the White House, like the Bushes and the Clintons. So it seems, like I said, more familiar and egalitarian. They eat dinner together. He clearly loves her. They're, you know, intellectual equals. But, you know, the practical day-to-day is not equal. But should we go back to Hillary for a moment?
Let's talk about Hillary for a moment.
I feel like we're going to talk about, you know, how much we want another woman president. It's going to be Sarah Palin. Like, that's what I realized at the end of my reverie and longing for another woman president. you know, and I
and that's
I was
not
actually
a
trying
happy
to bring
world
it,
for you?
Not a happy world. I was actually trying to bring it down to the substance, and I thought, okay, it is true that on international policy, you know, if I check with my gut, I do instinctively trust her more. Like, I trust her on Iran, not Afghanistan.
No, you're talking about Hillary Clinton.
I'm talking about
Sarah
Hillary
Palin.
Clinton, not Sarah Palin. Exactly. No, I trust her on, you know, Russia, Alaska, what? Hair extensions. So, you know, maybe that ball goes in her favor. And then in terms of domestic policy, like, clearly where she would have had a lot of interesting ideas and experience in healthcare, probably more experience with Congress, as, you know, all the profiles of her at the end of her time as a senator would say, like, the dirty little secret is that she has spent all this time kind of building bridges with Republicans and people who you wouldn't expect her to have relationships with. And that seemed to be the general consensus about her tenure as a senator. And so, you know, that might have gone well, because you can see that the relationship between Obama and Kong, you know, it has not gone swimmingly, right? So that would have been better. And then, but then you're left with a sort of right-wing backlash, which of course is not her fault, but you can imagine would have been just insane if she had been president. So I think we probably would have been left in the same place, kind of, in terms of domestic policy.
Right. I mean, the other thing I think about domestic policy is you would obviously have a completely different inner circle, and it would have been a lot of first Clinton administration people and a much more familiar inside the Beltway presence. And,
Yeah,
like he's not a familiar
right.
inside the Beltway. Well, that's what I was going to say, was that, you know, when Obama was elected and we were expecting this new wave of people to come in, that seemed like a more radical difference than it actually seems to me now that we do have Rahm Emanuel as chief of staff. Although,
right.
in all fairness, you know, people like Valerie Jarrett obviously have never been near the White House before, so there is some difference. But I don't know. I mean, I wonder if... even though Clinton had done all this bridge building and obviously had a lot of experience, whether it would have been very hard for her to escape the kind of straitjacket of expectations about Clintons that prevails in Washington and would have just made it impossible for her to actually succeed on the healthcare front.
I guess that's true. And then international diplomacy might have gone differently, actually, now that I think about it, if she weren't in a sort of freewheeling, freestanding position. In other words, this sort of that just kind of general flush of goodwill that the Obamas have every time they step in Europe, and then just general fascination and, you know, Michelle's arms and Michelle's clothes and all of that business would have been gone. They would have been greeted with a little bit of wariness. I mean, surely, you know, Bill Clinton has a lot of friends overseas, but there just would have been that tad of sort of that kind of sigh, right? You would have just felt like the wheels grinding, both in international diplomacy and domestic affairs and, you know, I don't know. Who knows what the actual accomplishments would have been, but it's not like Obama, you know, has huge amounts either to show quite yet.
Well, that's fair. That's true. But I also think, for example, in Afghanistan, that Obama's approach has been very ruminative. He is thinking his way through. He seems really committed to not rushing a decision. I don't think a woman president could have afforded to be seen as that slow-moving. I think she would have come out in a more forceful manner. We probably would have a troop buildup going on in Afghanistan unless she had decided to really immediately in her presidency distance herself from that counter-narrative about the Middle East and the dangers of terrorism in the, on the globe.
You know, it's funny. That's some. I don't know if you or somebody else said that in the discussion we had on Double X, which is running today, about, you know, the various opinions on what would have happened under Hillary. I'm just thinking, you know, actually now I have become curious, just from sort of a, you know, thinking about feminism perspective, what personality she would have adopted in internet. Like, would she have made herself a sort of Margaret Thatcher kind of person? Like, would she have made herself sort of tougher than tough? Like, what would have been her approach, you know? Because she spoke with such great authority during the campaign in a way, and owned those issues in a way that Obama never did, even though, you know, actually she didn't have, you know, very much experience. She had the experience of being her husband's wife, but she did kind of own those issues in a way that Obama never did and never has, and so I don't know, you know. And I wonder, you know, the other question is, I wonder what would have happened to feminism. I mean, this is a question nobody really addressed in the series of answers that we posted today, but what, you know, what, how that would have changed the conversation. Like, once there already is a female president kind of already engaged in these questions of kind of reputation and how a woman behaves in time of war, like, does that question just die, or are new questions raised, or has it become illegitimate to even talk about, like, to talk about the glass ceiling or any of those things anymore?
I think African Americans have faced these questions, right? I mean, right. There's been this backlash against complaining about the high rate of poverty among African Americans, all the discrimination they still face, because the feeling is, well, you got your boy wonder president, so everything must be totally great in your community, which of course is ridiculous. And I think women would have faced that same conundrum. I think on the front of having a female president who's also obviously commander-in-chief, it would have changed the conversation. We would take for granted pretty quickly that you can have a woman in that role. But I also think there would have been pressure on Hillary to be tough in a kind of traditional way, for exactly those reasons, because if you're going to have a woman in that position, you want her to be as close to the, you know, tough-as-nails male model as possible. It's just easier.
Right. Or at least you know that she'll be criticized if she's not.
Right.
Although that hasn't spared Obama, I have to say. I mean, he's fallen into a different trap, which is like the ruminating, you know, president, you know, the sort of academic rumination, you know, sort of that's hanging over his head in the way that femaleness would have been hanging over her head.
That's true.
I wonder if we would have sort of kept analyzing her, you know, outfits and her hair, or if that phase of the Hillary analysis was over.
I think it's funny that you mentioned that, because when I was imagining her for this exchange we had on Double X, I, in my first line of my entry, wrote about her wearing a pantsuit and kind of wondered what color it would have been. And someone immediately wrote in to say, oh, it was so bitchy of you to start with the pantsuit. But I didn't mean it in that way. I was just literally thinking about her standing up and giving an acceptance speech and how, you know, instead of wearing a dark man's suit, she would have been wearing one of her trademark outfits. I kind of liked that idea. I think we would still be talking about it. It'd be fun.
Although I have to say, I like having the kind of American fat. I like living through the sort of Jackie O moment, you know? It's just sort of
Jackie O goes to J. Crew moment?
No, I'm saying in the Michelle Obama way.
Yeah.
I like living through having a sort of, you know, minor fashion icon in the White House, you know, in the sense of the White House being a little bit cool, just as a resident of Washington. This is not a big point. This is just like, this is pleasing in a kind of minor way. to have.
Because you denizens of Washington always wish that you were cooler than you are.
Exactly.
Now you're like, getting a chance.
Exactly. I mean, like, when I wrote about this, but when I did our home exchange this summer, like, you know, everybody wanted to come to Washington, and everybody, you know, do the Obamas live near your house, and would we see the Obamas? And so it, you know.
And you were doing a home exchange with Europeans, right?
Exactly.
You were particularly prone to this.
Exactly. So, you know, with Hillary Clinton, it would have been like, oh, the red pantsuits. We don't want to see the red pantsuits. You know, what is her jogging outfit? Is it purple? You know, so.
All right. Well, so it was good for your home exchange,
exactly,
that
right,
Obama won. Now we've really got it all figured out.
All right.
I'm ready to talk about Mad Men, which I'm dying to talk about because I feel like the show has gotten so good in the past few weeks. Should we do a little recap about where we are in the series as we look forward to the finale on Sunday?
Yes. Well, we should mention that there is the finale on Sunday, and that, you know, something dramatic happened last week, which there was a lot of discussion about whether they were going to show this moment or not. And that moment, if you can guess, is the Kennedy assassination. And so, you know, it's this thing they would have to handle delicately because it would sort of, you know, they've been inching their way into the 60s, sort of from the early 60s into the kind of mid-late 60s throughout the show. And that would be just like a watershed moment, obviously. Like, everything has to change kind of on the personal and the political front on the show when that happens. And so they did do it. And they did it, I thought it was really, really great. I mean, in the way that they kind of interwove both the personal and the political and the cultural, kind of from the smallest questions of kind of how people watch TV in that age and how it changed to the kind of questions of, you know, all these personal kind of crises that have been building up just kind of, you know, exploded over the Kennedy assassination, which could be kind of as a narrative trick very phony, but in fact, because we all lived through 9/11, seemed completely organic, because in fact, as many 9/11 novels and kind of, you know, art stories and relationships and personal testimonies, those are moments in which you kind of come to terms with, like, where you want to live, who you love, who you don't love. You know, there's all these stories after 9/11 of people either coming together or getting divorced. And so, to me anyway, I don't know about you, Emily, the kind of resolving of various personal dynamics around the question of the Kennedy assassination seemed very, very well handled.
Oh, I agree. I thought it was pretty masterful. I want to talk about the TV watching for a minute, because one of the tropes of the show was watching children watch the Kennedy assassination,
right,
and watch the aftermath. And this question Don Draper, the main character, says to his wife, Betty, you know, why are you letting the kids watch this? And she says, what do you want me to do, not tell them that it happened? But I also felt like we were absorbing some of the just terror of what it's like to have the president assassinated through the eyes of these kids. And then there's a very sweet moment late in the show where Don's young son, who's probably like 7 or 8, says to his father, are we going to the funeral?
Right.
And I thought it was very moving. I could completely imagine one of my kids asking a question like that, just trying to make sense of the way in which everything had changed and the adults around you are shattered.
You know, that moment has been set up pretty well too, because we've had lots of moments throughout the season of the kids staring blankly at the TV. That's a trope that comes up a lot. It's a trope that's intended to shed light on a certain kind of parenting, you know. They always
right.
say go watch TV when they want to get the kids out of the room and they want to watch something. There was that scene when Sally was kind of losing it. Sally's becoming kind of a difficult child.
Sally's
and
the
she
daughter.
Watched, huh?
Sally's the
daughter, sorry, and she watched The Monk set himself on fire on TV when nobody was paying attention, and that's when things got really, really, really weird. And in this episode, it kind of got weird and normalized at the same time and suddenly felt very modern, you know, because what it's about is the breakdown of kind of surfaces and hiding things from your children and hiding things from each other. And so, you know, the surprise is that kind of Betty's moving there more quickly than Don. You know, she's had this affair, and in this episode...
She had an affair last season, like a really quick affair.
But right,
now
but I mean...
This-
Now
she's having a budding affair, right?
She's having this budding affair, I guess. I mean, it's an affair, right? She kissed him, so when
you think a kiss is enough for an affair? We could discuss that.
We could discuss that for a while. She's having a freaking affair. What should we call it? Like,
you're
an
not
emotional
supposed
affair?
To kiss people.
No, because emotional affair
husband.
Is like
you.
When you didn't kiss him, right? What? Because she had to sleep with him? I mean, it's like 1962, right?
Okay.
Anyway, okay. She's having a maybe affair. She's being courted. How about that?
That's good. She's courting.
By
too.
A man other than her husband, whom she was also courting. And you know. And so, but all this time, you know, it's been Dawn who's been one step ahead, and Betty who's been the kind of protected, childish ice queen, and Dawn who's the one who's the keeper of secrets, who kind of is tuned into homosexuality and unplanned pregnancy, and he kind of knows things and kind of controls things, including his own identity. But in this episode, it all got kind of turned, and Betty became the person who sort of fast-forwarded into the new age. She's like, you know, suddenly, why is it okay to let the kids watch the Kennedy assassination? Because we don't keep secrets anymore. Like, we don't, it's fine, right? You don't have to protect everyone from everything, because she is now at this moment, you know, just told her husband she doesn't love him. She didn't feel anything when he kissed her, and she wants to leave him, we assume, is the next step. And so, you know, and if you think about it, this makes sense, because statistically, and particularly in what happened in the 70s, which was a sort of, you know, explosion of divorce, it's the women who initiate divorce. It's the women who are kind of tuned into whether they're happy or unhappy. And so it does make sense that Don, you know, would be happy to keep his life going forever, you know, in the essential model of the early 60s. He thrives in that world. But in a world in which there are no more secrets, then the person who's the kind of masterful keeper of the secrets kind of loses his, you know, dominion. So anyway, that kind of all happened really beautifully in the last episode, I thought.
Right, no, I agree. And then the other thing about the secrets shifting is that Don has this false identity. I mean, he literally, in Korea, took another soldier's dog tags, never went back to the absolutely horrible upbringing he had in, where did he grow up? Like, Kentucky? Anyway, it seems absolutely awful, this, like, impoverished, child-abusing family he came from, and he abandoned his much younger half-brother, who then committed suicide in an earlier season, and he has been hiding all of that from Betty and everyone he knows in his made-up New York world. Betty discovered these secrets a couple of weeks ago, and suddenly the power dynamic between them completely altered. And Joshua Hamm, the actor who plays Don Draper, I thought, conveyed this in a way that really surprised me. I mean, we've enjoyed watching his total shellacked veneer for 2.5 seasons. He is just, like, always has it together. He is in command. And suddenly he is not that way at all anymore. And I felt like his eyes really changed. Like, you can see the whites of his eyes. You can see the fear in them. He looks, like, sort of haggard and dog-eyed around Betty, who now knows the truth about him.
You know, it's funny. Yeah.
Go ahead. No, please.
I can see where Betty's going.
Mm-hmm.
But I
can't tell.
See where Don's going. Like, I feel like what you described is absolutely true. But I don't know, you know,
what they're going to do now.
Both as an actor, you know, if the range goes beyond kind of breaking the surface, and then what, right? Because we did have that brief period where Don was kind of living free, where we had a glimpse into, you know, him just kind of living the crazy
philandering in California.
Exactly.
That actually wasn't very interesting.
Yeah, that was very interesting, but just didn't seem sustainable or fit or kind of organic to me in any way. So, you know, if that's the new Don, that's very hard to make sense of. I guess he can go to the latest woman he's been having an affair with, who he seems really into, the, you know, he's hot for sex.
The Earth Mother teacher, although she's so annoying.
Yeah, she's very annoying.
She's too Earth Mother for me. Yeah, I think that's a really good question, but watching him fall apart, essentially, and be suddenly very dependent on Betty, not simply because she could out him in a literal sense, but because she is now, she knows the truth, and so if she does stand by him, it means that this transition is one that he has actually accomplished, and that he can be his real self in a totally different way in his own home. She now
But
holds
she
all
won't want
him.
I mean, that's
no.
The irony here. It's like, this is a little bit Hillary and Bill Clinton, where she becomes her best. This is what people used to say about Hillary Clinton, her becoming her best when Bill was having an affair, and she knew, and she had found it out, because suddenly she held the cards, and he was kind of, you know, he was enthralled to her, and he owed her something, and so it was when she had the upper hand, and kind of everything was out on the table. It's sort of a little bit of the dynamic going on now. I love how we're talking about these fictional people as if they are the president, the ex-president, and their equivalent, but let's let that slide for a minute.
Oh, I think it's totally fine. This is like, Ben Schwartz wrote about this in The Atlantic, these TV shows, Mad Men, The Sopranos, The Wire, For You and Me, 6 Feet Under, Deadwood? Yeah, I love
Friday Night Lights for me.
Friday Night Lights, you and I are obsessed with Friday Night Lights. They are our Dickens, I think. They're like our narrative that gets serialized over weeks and months and that we, talk to each other about, and they're like, they become our friends, these people. I feel totally self-conscious about that.
Well, I will just insert this, that Friday Night Lights is on DirecTV, where very few people watch it, but of course I caught it last week, and I woke up dreaming about them. Like, can they come for dinner? Is that okay? Coach and Mrs. Coach come for dinner? Just so embarrassing.
I have no DirecTV. We'll be waiting for NBC, but can't wait for that show to come back. And in the meantime, I'm really curious about what note Mad Men chooses to end on this coming Sunday. We know we get to look forward to a couple of new seasons. And I think, as you started out by saying, the whole narrative arc this season has been about things falling apart, about how the 60s explodes all these conventions, the mid-60s, the late-60s, that we've seen so dearly held by not just Don and Betty, but characters like Peggy, who's the secretary-turned-ad copywriter, and Pete and Trudy Campbell, this very privileged couple who have seemed like miserable, spoiled brats, but now, maybe are on the verge of some slightly different shift in existence.
And I will confess that I actually was not looking forward to this moment. I actually thought that the whole show's premise was in holding this tension before everything let loose, before sort of civil rights in the early to late 60s. And the beginning of the season was a little shaky for me for that reason. Like, I didn't want to see sort of Don let loose in the end of last season.
Or Peggy smoking pot.
It just seemed totally uninteresting to me. But actually now it's kind of totally regained its footing, and it's kind of it's like shattering, everything in small pieces in a way which I think is incredibly interesting. And I can almost, I'm just making this up, I can almost see it play out where sort of Betty goes through a phase of feeling incredibly liberated, after which she enters a marriage, which is exactly like the marriage she has now. I mean, that seems to be the way it goes, and sort of Don, I don't know what, Don marries the annoying Earth Mama teacher or something. But
no, I refuse. I don't like that scenario.
So it is kind of keeping my interest completely, I would say.
Right. Before we close, I have to mention the other characters I love dearly on this show. Roger Sterling, his horrible, increasingly horrible new wife, Jane, and then Joan, the secretary he should have married. Instead, he left his nice, older, appropriate wife, Mona, for this Jane, who turns out to be completely immature. And there has just been this great sort of subplot in the last few weeks where Roger is increasingly treating Jane like a child, calling Joan up for comfort. And Joan is another of these female characters who I think comes to stand for a whole larger phenomenon, and then we go around thinking about, like, oh, do we dress like Joan or like Betty? Who's our archetype here? And Joan is like the
wise... Can I just say, I wish?
What'd you say?
I wish, either you... one. Like, if we could freeze frame this blogging hedge and have, like, Joan and Betty on one side, you think a lot more people would watch it?
No, I can't imagine what you're talking about. I just wish I had time to go buy a piece of clothing.
You're right.
I
love that. David and I said, if you could, like, freeze frame the show and just have, like, Roger and Joan all the time, I would be really, really happy. I just, like, I love when those two come on the show. And, by the way, I meant to write about this. No, Joan was seen in D.C. There was some gossip about her in the Washington Post on Monday.
Oh, really?
With a staffer for Frank Lautenberg.
Ooh, that's a pairing that we might
now help me out on that one. And I actually meant to Google him to see sort of what they described him as very handsome, but curiously didn't have a picture of him and the style. Gossip. So I meant to put out like a hunt for him, like, who is this guy? I don't remember.
Oh, you should.
Huh?
You still should.
I really still should, because I'm incredible. I mean, she literally must be the most desired woman in America today, and she's going out with like a congressional staffer.
Wait, remind everyone who Frank Lautenberg is, which side of the aisle.
He's a New Jersey Democrat, sorry.
Thank you, I forgot the state, so. I had to be enlightened. All right, I think we're ready to close. And
yes.
Since it's Election Day, everyone should go out and vote. I'm feeling very smug about having already voted for town alderman this morning.
Yeah, good for you. Yay,
all right.
Emily, do you have your button to show?
I do. I have my sticker, although I'm not actually wearing it right now, but my kids came with me and proudly went off to school with their I Voted Today stickers.
Excellent.
All right. Have a great day, Hannah.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.